I'm Katie Cantrell, and I'm the Director of Corporate Outreach for the Better Food Foundation.
Okay, and are you still also affiliated with Factory Food Awareness Coalition?
Yes, I am also the board chair of the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition and the founder.
Okay, great. So talk about, you know, we're heading into Thanksgiving and then Christmas, and, you know, one of the things that you've worked really hard on, among many, is like really helping people learn about the benefits of plant-based eating. And at the holidays, we see that people are very big about promoting, you know, you can buy a whole turkey or you can order a whole ham. So I'm curious what comes to your mind around this, the work that you do around the holiday season, when we see the way that these holidays have really been, they're really used to promote meat in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough time. You know, I think for people who are vegetarian or vegan or so inclined, it can be really difficult to like sit around, you know, at a table where there's, you know, it's centered around these you know, animals that have been slaughtered for food. And I think especially Thanksgiving, you know, some people find it ironic that this day of like giving thanks for family and life also is a day for which 45 million turkeys are killed just to be eaten on Thanksgiving. But you know, it's also hard. Like, there's a reason that in January people are so eager to make resolutions to eat healthier and to diet, which is that most people like overindulge on the holidays too, and that doesn't feel great either. You know, feeling like stuffed and sluggish, and so, you know, it's I think a fraught time for a lot of people. But you know, there are some ways to make even small changes that can be empowering and kind of help with all these things.
Let's talk about some of those.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I think it depends on obviously the situation of like who's hosting and how open they are to making changes. But, you know, for people who are already interested in eating more plant-based foods, whether for health or for sustainability or for animals, just, you know, cooking and bringing delicious foods that people can try is a really great strategy. There's a lot of really simple substitutions that can be made to make most Thanksgiving foods plant-based. You know, obviously there's turkey and ham, but really most of the rest of the dishes are pretty plant forward already. You know, mashed potatoes and yams and green beans and stuffing, like they're already mostly plant-based. So things like just using vegan milks or butters instead, like there's really simple switches that can make them plant-based. And you know, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about lately is that doing so is actually a lot more inclusive. So we've been encouraging people who aren't necessarily vegan themselves to make those switches in order to make sure that more people can eat the foods that they're making. So, you know, obviously people who are vegetarian and vegan would appreciate that, but also people who are lactose intolerant, who have egg allergies, who have religious restrictions. I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons that people might not want dishes that are full of, you know, milk and butter and eggs and beef stock and those sorts of things. And then also, you know, in terms of feeling better too, plant-based foods, you can get the same really delicious textures and flavors. It's really, you know, mostly about the seasoning in terms of how these dishes taste, but they're not as heavy when they're plant-based. They don't have all that cholesterol and saturated fat, so you can indulge and, you know, not feel quite as guilty.
Okay, and you said earlier that 45 million turkeys are slaughtered in the United States just for Thanksgiving. Is that right?
Yes.
So we know that chickens are factory farmed. Is the same true for turkeys?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, turkeys, the vast majority of turkeys are factory farmed. So they are raised in incredibly unnatural conditions. And they actually, turkeys can't even mate normally. They can't physically mate anymore because they've been bred to be so artificially large and, you know, to have these really large breasts. So they actually, like, male turkeys can't even mount female turkeys anymore. They have to be artificially inseminated.
So what kind of impact would it make if some people, like, if people decided, okay, this Thanksgiving we're going to not include turkey, we're going to try a plant-based option? Some people, I hear the argument, well, I could make that change, but what good would it do? The turkeys are already, you know, existing and being slaughtered anyways. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on a very literal level, it's true, especially this close to Thanksgiving. But, you know, the turkeys have a pretty short lifespan, and they only exist because they are bred into existence to be slaughtered for food. And so, you know, sure, one person might not make a difference, but it's like voting, where, like, you know, if a million people suddenly make a change, then those are just one person, like, it's a million individuals, but collectively, they can really shift the market or, you know, the outcome of an election. So if demand for turkey drops a lot and demand for plant-based products increases a lot, then businesses take note of those trends. And, you know, they will adjust production and adjust what they're investing in. And grocery stores really take note and adjust how much shelf space they're giving to plant-based products. And then it, you know, it can help create this positive feedback loop where as plant-based products become more popular, more of them are available, they cost less, they're advertised more people start to buy them, and then they become a larger and larger percentage of the market and just kind of more of a normal part of Thanksgiving.
And if we look at that model, something similar happened with milk, right? At first, you know, there was a couple of plant-based options, and now it seems like even in Wisconsin, where milk is a big, there's a big dairy industry, even in California, like it almost seems like the rationale that's being used in the marketing campaigns is like support a farmer, drink milk, as opposed to drink milk, it's good for you, because there's now so many plant-based options. So I suppose what you're saying is maybe in the immediate, it might not make a difference tomorrow, but in the long run, if we decrease the demand, that might be where the shift happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on an interpersonal level, too, it really makes a difference. If you're, you know, if you have kids at your table, or if you're having family over or friends, you know, we really, the work that I'm doing now in particular is really about shifting norms and just making plant-based foods more accessible and normalized for everyone. Realizing that, you know, vegan food isn't just for vegans, but anyone can make a plant-based dessert or, you know, side dish for their Thanksgiving. And so, you know, the more that we serve these foods and expose people to how delicious they are, and they realize they feel better after eating them, and, you know, maybe you'll chat about how they have a lower carbon footprint, then those people are more likely to eat them and try them and share them with their friends. So again, it has this kind of reinforcing positive feedback loop element to it.
Great. And now you're also involved in a campaign to help maybe businesses, corporations, educational institutions shift to having their main course be plant-based. Can you talk more about that program and why that's important?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'm helping to spearhead this program called Greener by Default, / Default Veg. Default Veg is kind of the public facing side. And then when we work with institutions, that policy focus is called Greener by Default. But, you know, the core idea is really simple. It's just flipping the norm. So, you know, right now, pretty much everywhere meat is the default, and people have to specially opt in to veg options, which only strict vegetarians and vegans are going to think to request a veg option or go out of their way to look for it. And so this just flips it to make plant-based the default and give people the choice to opt into meat and dairy. So nothing is taken off the menu. Everyone still has total freedom of choice, but meat is no longer just assumed to be everyone's default. It kind of helps to nudge people towards the more sustainable, healthy, and inclusive options.
And what kind of response have you gotten to this?
It's been overwhelmingly positive so far. It's great to see that, you know, a lot of companies and especially universities are already thinking about adding more plant-based options because it is becoming more and more popular, you know, especially with young people. So that, you know, they realize that the trend in this direction only continues to grow. And also there's such an emphasis on cutting carbon and water footprints, you know, like attaining these carbon reduction goals that businesses and universities have set. So it's a really powerful way to help with that. And it's great because it's not taking away freedom of choice. It's not controversial in the way like a Meatless Mondays is, or something where you're like forcing everyone to be meatless. Just the fact that people still have that choice open to them makes them feel a lot better about it.
That's great. And now you're mentioning the environmental aspect, which is significant. We know that they just had climate talks and many people are feeling fairly discouraged. It sounds like, you know, there was like a mediocre kind of commitment to work toward you know, coal reduction, but the language was more like, let's try rather than we will.
Yeah.
So what do you want people to think about in terms of the climate? You know, people automatically go towards thinking about coal and oil and don't always think about the impact of even the food that we're eating. So I wonder if you would like to weigh in on that issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, it's certainly a prescient topic right now. You know, there's a few things there. One is that even though it doesn't get talked about so much, animal agriculture is one of the leading causes of climate change. There's been several studies now that have shown that even if every other industry became completely carbon neutral by 2050, so energy, transportation, buildings, completely carbon neutral, but we leave the food system to continue on its current trajectory, we would still fail to meet the Paris Climate Accord. The food system alone would take us past 1.5 degrees of warming. So we truly cannot keep climate change within manageable levels without tackling the food system. It's just it's a key part of the solution. But the good news there is that it's a part of the system that we have a unique amount of control over, because, you know, the energy grid, even, you know, most of us can't afford to buy a Tesla. If you're renting a house, you can't, you know, you don't have the choice to put solar panels on the roof, but we can all eat, you know, a veggie burrito instead of a beef burrito, or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead of a ham sandwich. So it's great because it's a really accessible way that everyone can make a significant difference.
And even though maybe a vegan item in a restaurant might be expensive in some cases, if you're cooking at home, it really is the more affordable option as well, right?
Yeah, and that's something that surprises a lot of people because, yeah, in restaurants it's often more expensive and a lot of the specialty products can be more expensive. But, yeah, they've done studies on a family of four that switches to a vegetarian diet over the course of a year saves like $700 on groceries, because most of the veg protein staples like beans, lentils, tofu are cheaper than meat, and especially if you're buying them in bulk. I mean, there is no cheaper protein than like bulk beans or bulk lentils.
Yeah. And I guess the one other topic that's related and maybe contradicts this a little I'm going to just share this with you and see if you've heard of this and see if you have some commentary. But over the summer, I spent some time in Wisconsin in a small town, and I was really surprised to see that, you know, the crops were down because of climate change and the drought and all these different factors that are impacting people seemingly across the world. However, you could go to the local Quick Trip and you can buy an entire steak or for maybe 99 cents a pound, or a chicken for hardly anything. But to buy a pack of cucumbers, it was something like $7. And so what has to happen? And I think this is something that other small towns in different places are experiencing. So I wonder what we can do for this in the food justice movement to make sure that healthy options do stay affordable and, they are, I don't know, that it is like economically possible to eat vegetables if you're not growing them yourself. Like, what do we need to keep doing?
Yeah, it's a really important question and a big issue. And it's just crazy because, you know, the United States has really flipped all of like food history on its head, because, you know, throughout the rest of human history and in pretty much every other country, meat is the ultimate luxury food. Like, usually only rich people and like royals could afford to eat meat, and peasant food was like mostly vegetables. And, you know, if you had a cow, like you would milk it and have some milk, but eating meat was like for really special occasions. And it's just through the system of factory farming and through subsidies that we've really flipped that on its head, and suddenly now meat is really cheap. And that's why, you know, I talk to a lot of people whose parents immigrated to the United States, and they, you know, are so proud that they can eat meat every day because it's a sign that they've made it. You know, they're now in this land of plenty. So it is, you know, it's a complicated topic. A lot of it has to do with subsidies and with even more wonky topics like crop insurance that, you know, are unfortunately like relatively hard for individuals to shift. The farm bill that comes up for about roughly every 5 years determines a lot of these policies, so that's coming up again. And, you know, getting involved in that, like calling your legislator, telling them that you want more support for plant-based proteins. Cory Booker and has sponsored a bill called the Farm Systems Reform Act, and that would be really revolutionary. It would actually call for a moratorium on factory farms, and have a lot of increased support for small farmers and farmers of color and, you know, healthy fruits and vegetables. So that's one thing that that people can do, is to call your legislator and encourage them to sign on to the Farm System Reform Act.
Okay, that's great. And thank you for sharing that. And before we conclude, I wanted to circle back to something that you mentioned in passing at the beginning of the interview. You talked about how plant-based options are the more inclusive option in many cases, because there's different nuances with people from particular belief systems who might avoid one type of food or another. So I wonder if you could comment on just kind of elaborating on that, and then thinking also about intersectional issues. We think about, you know, race, class, gender identity. How does food connect to our intersectional identities and, you know, the complex systems of oppression and privilege? I'm realizing this is a really big question to throw at you, but you're always a brilliant responder. So, you know,
thank you.
What does it bring up for you?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly is a huge question, and obviously a very, you know, complicated and kind of fraught topic. But I think there's a lot of different ways that they intersect. So, you know, certainly one is the injustices of the factory farming industry are mostly borne by low-income communities of color, from the workers on factory farms and slaughterhouses who face these just unbearable working conditions that leave them often crippled for life and with PTSD. Also, the communities where factory farms are built, their property values plummet because no one wants to live near a factory farm, and their health suffers because of all of the environmental pollution. And they can't then, you know, if they've bought their house, they've sunk all of their investment, all of their savings into a house, suddenly that house is worthless and all of their, you know, their family funds are gone, and so they can't even escape from the cycle. So there's a lot of environmental racism caused by the factory farming industry. So, you know, I think that's a big piece of it. But obviously it's complicated. I know there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, traditional food ways and a lot of cultural foods, you know, at least for the last couple hundred years, have meat and dairy in them. And so sometimes there can be like an issue of feeling like I'm losing my culture or betraying my culture if I'm turning my back on these traditional foods. And so there's been a lot of powerful discussion around that lately. There's actually a great book that's coming out by Christopher Carter called The Spirit of Soul Food that looks at his own family history and his own like personal relationship with food as he's learned about the realities of how food is produced and, you know, how that relates to, you know, what foods have been historically eaten by Black communities and like the, you know, the spirit that goes into that food and how that can be respected and preserved while not further perpetuating other types of injustices. I'm not really doing that book justice, but it's just coming out in a couple of months, and it's, you know, that's a fantastic kind of glimpse into this dialogue that's going on right now about looking at traditional foods and, you know, how a lot of these diets have really been shaped by colonialism. Kind of a classic example of that is milk and how it's just forced on, especially on kids, but really it's dairy is so prevalent in society when most communities of color are lactose intolerant. So actually Lauren Arnellis from the Food Empowerment Project refers to it as lactose normal, because 75% of adults around the world are actually quote unquote lactose intolerant. So really if most people are lactose intolerant, that should be called lactose normal. It's mostly people of European descent who have this genetic mutation that allows them to drink milk from cows. So, you know, like, why are we forcing milk on kids and just putting it in everything when, you know, the majority of people worldwide and, you know, majority of people of color in the United States are not able to digest that and it makes them sick. So, you know, that's just like one glimpse into how these European kind of colonial ways of eating have been forced onto different communities all around the world.
Yeah, that's so interesting. In fact, I can't really think of anybody who I know who doesn't have of any kind of background, including European descent, that is like, oh yeah, it works great for me to drink a lot of milk. So I think that's a really important point you're raising. We've covered a lot of territory. Is there anything else that you wanted to include before we conclude, knowing that, you know, Thanksgiving, the holidays are coming up? Any final things that we should keep in mind?
Just a couple of things. So one, you know, for anyone who's interested in plant-based recipes, I just, you know, Google it. Like, it sounds kind of cliche to say, but like there's so many amazing vegan recipes and resources out there anymore that I don't even know which to recommend. So, you know, I just like anything I'm in the mood to try, I'll Google, you know, vegan. The other day I saw a recipe for like vegan pecan pie bars. And so I'm going to make those for Thanksgiving. But anything in the world you can dream of, if you Google it, there are vegan recipes, and most of them have ratings and comments, and so you can find the ones that people liked. And, you know, maybe just try out a new recipe this holiday season. You know, have some fun, try out something new. And the other thing I wanted to say, just to give a little pitch for the work that we're doing at Greener by Default, we really love to work with advocates within institutions. That's the main way that we get wins, is having an ally within a university or within a business. So if you are interested in making the food at your place of work or study or worship, whatever it might be, plant-based by default, then please get in touch. The website is www.greenerbydefault.com. And even if you don't have like a corporate cafeteria at your work, even if you have like monthly catered meetings, post-COVID times, I know there's not much food service right now, but, you know, we work with institutions of all different sizes.
Okay, that's fantastic. And have you had any traction before we, I should have spent more time on this topic earlier. Have you had any traction, or have you made any attempts to introduce the Greener by Default option to like elementary schools? Now that the many schools, like this particular year, the Biden administration said, like, provide universal free lunch, although it's not happening in my children's district, but you know, the expectation was that people should provide free lunch, and like California is working toward providing free lunch next academic year. But have you thought about talking with elementary schools about this project, and what kind of response have you had, if you have done that?
Yeah, you know, we actually don't work with K through 12 schools. Unfortunately, it's just it's a big lift. You know, if it's a public school, then the food is decided at the district level, but it's really constrained by federal guidelines and federal funding, and it's just kind of a mess, a big bureaucratic mess. It can be done, and there are some wonderful organizations that are working on it, especially Friends of the Earth. They're doing a lot of great work trying to pass legislation both in California and federally to increase the funding for schools that want to serve plant-based foods, because they're often more expensive, as we've talked about, with subsidies and all of that. So yeah, we don't work directly with schools. We just work with universities and businesses and conferences and nonprofits, because it's just so time intensive to try to get a school district to change the foods that they're serving. But it is a wonderful effort. You know, I really admire, and I'm grateful for the groups that do that work.
Yes. And I just want to spend a little bit more time talking about subsidies. So who decided that there would be government subsidies to make, you know, to really subsidize the consumption of meat and cheese? Because it does seem like that is what the subsidies are primarily for, right? And why are there no subsidies for vegetables or plant-based options, or fewer subsidies?
Yeah, I mean, if you want a very thorough dive into the topic, there's a fantastic book called Foodopoly by Winona Hodder, who's the founder of Food and Water Watch. It's a really fascinating and disturbing look at how the politics of really the last, like, even like 200 years almost, but especially the last 100 years, have shaped our current food system. So, you know, these kind of like robber barons almost needed young men to work in their factories, and they needed to get them off the farm in order to do that. And so it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it was basically this cabal of like rich businessmen who were like, how do we get these young men to stop working on their family farms and start working in our factories? Basically drive the small farmers out of business so that they can't work on the farm anymore. And that started in process this you know, like decades and decades and decades of really bad government policies that favor these big business interests over small farmers. And it's a sordid and sad history. But yeah, I mean, basically corporate influence is the short answer. And, you know, really at every level, I mean, local, state and federal, agribusiness is still one of the most powerful lobbies. So they just, you know, make it politically infeasible for anyone to change the subsidy system.
Okay. We've covered a lot of topics. remind us again how we can get in touch with you and follow any of these programs that you've mentioned.
Yeah, so the website is greenerbydefault.com, and there's a contact form on there too.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Sharon.